Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are cleaning up discourse, world discourse. I was going to say American discourse, but today I'm talking farther out into the world. One unethical persuader at a time. It's complicated times out there. It requires more sophisticated techniques. So we're trying to give people some of that. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor, and late night comedy writer from Hollywood. Also founder of Rhetoric Warriors, where I try to teach people rhetorical principles that I think can be helpful. My guest this week on the podcast, we do three things. I convert conservatives because I think they need some thinking help. I also talk to comedians and explore their politics, which is always fascinating. And I bring on persuasion pros or people that are involved in some way in rhetorical, interesting rhetorical activity in the world. And that's this guy this week. I don't know anything about him other than we met on LinkedIn and we've now talked for 10 minutes before we started here. But he has a very interesting organization that I really am fascinated to explore. This is Simon Gibson, founder of World Speech Day. And like I said, I love rhetoric. This is one of my areas of interest in life. So seeing somebody doing something like this really fascinates me. So we're going to explore that today. Simon, how are you doing?
Hi, yeah, very well, Dan. And lovely to have the opportunity to chat and explore things, all things rhetoric and speeches and speech making. As you kindly mentioned, I was the founder of World Speech Day, which started off 6 years ago, more or less in one of those light bulb moments. Mm-hmm. I was working on a database of contemporary and historic speeches at the time, and daily going through speeches and both analyzing them and collating them. And so I'd read everything from, you know, the speeches by American president to the speeches by the president of the Philippines or the Bank of England or the Fed or whatever. There were all of these speeches coming in all the time, and I put them into a database and I thought about them and I read them. And
what database was it
called VoiceGig, and it was a database for historic and contemporary speeches.
Okay.
And the light bulb moment was really as I read all of these, it just was apparent that speeches change the world, and that's sometimes seen as a rather boastful comment, or rather over egging the pudding, as it were. But it did seem to me that that was the case, that almost in all walks of life, from politics to religion to business, speeches are the way that ideas are first shared and spread. They're the way that visions get put out there. And so it was an interesting observation. I can talk a little bit more about that later, that kind of vision thing of how you get speeches to put out the way you want the world to be. But back to World Speech Day, I had this, you know, moment of clarity that speeches change the world, and wouldn't it be good to do something with that thought and to do something for the good, if one possibly can, in a very small way. And so I came up with World Speech Day as a way to share speeches and speech making and to celebrate them. From the very beginning, we just went out there and started it up, and started really at the bottom by just connecting people who were interested in speeches and speech making, be those speech writers or members of Toastmasters or TED or whoever. And actually, the idea has caught on. People do enjoy World Speech Day and organizing speaking events to celebrate World Speech Day. It's highly devolved, so anybody can speak and anybody can host an event. And we've grown from that original light bulb moment 6 years ago to hosting annually events in some 100 countries. And the range of events can be, you know, from a school to a university debating hall to an NGO to parliament buildings in Mongolia. Huge range of events, and very heartening that it is so broad. You know, we don't aim for elite speakers. We don't aim although it's lovely if they take part, but we aim much more transparently and broadly than that. And kind of our mantra is to reach out to unexpected voices.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. Your website's incredibly multicultural and multi-regional. And you can see that, you know, it's got a lot of young kids on it. It's got a lot of, you know, people from that you normally wouldn't hear, at least, you know, in America. You know, we have a fairly limited range of speakers that we ever get to hear from. It's almost always politicians, you know. Every once in a while, there'll be a movement, you know, that'll start up and you'll get a little clip here and there through TV of somebody doing some form of monologue, you know, about a social issue. But it's such a small range of what's actually out there. And one of the cool things about what you've got set up is that it shows you the expansiveness of, you know, the human participation in this kind of monologue communication, you know, and how natural it is to people. And you know, it's just fascinating to see just looking from your website. I'm just like, wow, look at this, represents it so differently.
Yeah, well, it is always fascinating. You know, as I say, we reach out to unexpected voices, to people who wouldn't normally even think of making a speech, but they come forward and they do. And I guess the notion there is that, you know, anybody can have good ideas. It isn't necessarily the elite or the educated or the well-connected that have good ideas and the sort of ideas that take us forward. And so we've rightly or wrongly been able to bring them in. And the other extraordinary thing is how good people are at speaking. You know, there is this counter notion that, you know, there's only one thing that people fear more than death, and it's making a speech, which is a cliche which one hears so often. But actually, you know, people are naturally quite good at making speeches very often, and they can be a 6-year-old in India or a 60-year-old in London, but that's uplifting.
It's interesting, you know, people, we get so much. So I was a professor, a rhetoric professor, for almost 20 years, and I've taught just a range of classes, and it's usually, you know, kids that are 18 to 20 year olds coming into university to take the courses. But I've seen this massive range of people. The communication training that we get naturally is most commonly dialogue. And we've had hundreds of thousands of conversations, you know, and everybody basically knows how they go and they get very practiced at it. Your giving speeches is much rarer, you know, it's a rare experience. I think that's why people think they fear it, because they just don't understand, you know, all the tools and techniques which make it easy. Like once you've done 100 of these, like I've done 3,000 stand-up comedy shows, you know, and you can't put me on any stage anywhere and make me nervous.
Really?
I've seen everything.
You know? Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah.
But for the most part, people don't get a lot of experience doing speeches. And that's, again, one of the things when I saw your organization pop up online, I'm like, well, that's a great opportunity for people. And it's this bigness of it, this idea that you're doing, everybody across the world is doing, and it gives it an importance. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's fun. I comes to mind a quotation from Malcolm Gladwell about there's no excuse for being nervous about making a speech. You just got to practice. And it's having that opportunity. And I guess things like, you know, new technology and phones can give us that. Now we can practice making a speech into our phone and critique it and get better. And the other great thing is that once you've given a speech, maybe to your local village hall or school or whatever, it can have a profound effect on your overall confidence. You know, if it goes well, and you know, let's hope it does, then people are transformed. And there are people who say, well, that, you know, it has literally, you know, changed my life, my career pattern, and so forth. So there's always a danger to over, you know, reach these things, but it does feel that that speech making can be quite not uplifting, but quite fulfilling, put it that way.
Well, I think it does have that. And so my background is, I was a writer. I was an undergraduate, I had an English degree. And writing is so insular, it's so done by yourself for the most part. You know, when it goes out into the world, you have some interaction with the world. But I moved over to speech communication and writing speeches and understanding, you know, public rhetoric, because it's just so much more communal. There's so much more, you know, live energy in it. There's so much more immediacy to it than there is in writing for me. And so instantly, as soon as you move over, people get nervous about turning in their writing, but it's so rarely read out loud. But then when they do it, you know, they show themselves in public to all these judges.
Yeah. You know,
they start to feel that sense of, oh, this has an importance to it because it has the ability to give me feedback from multiple people, from a crowd, then it's going to have more weight than if one person, you know, likes this or not. So it has a gravitas to it. It has, you know, it has a texture that normal communication doesn't have.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, of course, you know, it's the magic of the audience, isn't it? That changes the speech from something mundane to something magical. And that's a whole separate subject. I'd be really fascinated, and maybe now, maybe later, to talk to you about what you've learned as a stand-up comedian to giving speeches. And because it seems to me that there you've got a real interaction between yourself and the audience. You've got to be like a cat in terms of interpreting what's going on in front of you. And maybe speeches and speech makers could learn an enormous amount from that kind of experience of being super aware of the audience.
Yeah, I think stand-up is interesting for a lot of reasons for that kind of stuff, because it really is a dialogue with the audience. It looks like a monologue, but it's a pseudo monologue. And the cool thing is when you're creating stand-up, you know, stand-ups will go up and do open mic nights to try out material. And then they'll do that material over and over again. So really you're co-writing it with the audience. The audience gives you a very clear signal about whether what you're saying is working or not.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you can't even just get half a laugh or the audience. It's gotta be 100% spontaneous, really powerful laughter. Then you know it's cooked, you know, then you know, oh, okay, I can move on to the next part. So it's the best creative loop, because it's instant and very clear feedback, and most speakers never get that.
No, exactly. But it would be interesting to develop that kind of sixth sense, wouldn't it? I mean, to have that, and maybe the great speakers do, you know, that they can, you know, sense where the audience is going. I mean, I'm continually amazed about this notion of audience and how that frames the speech and how it changes the way that speeches are received and so on. It's a very brilliant area of research, I think.
Yeah. And it's super, like when I do stand up now, I'm a writer. So I write thousands of jokes and I've got routine, and there's a reason why it's called routine, right? It's incredibly patterned and incredibly word for word. And your job becomes to act it well. I don't particularly find that interesting. I'm not a performer by nature. I find writing interesting. So when I do stand-up, I usually go up without a script and I just talk to the audience for an hour.
Right.
Because my brain, I've done so much stand-up for so long, my brain is really fast with comedy. And so being able to create in the moment like that with an audience is just super fun.
Yes, yes. Well, I can imagine that's, you know, like all, you know, it's a kind of skill that is developed with practice, you know, with this golden thing that gets us better, trains our minds and gets us sort of focused onto the right patterns. It must be an extraordinary experience. I think I would probably rather die than go. No, I'm
sure everybody says.
I'm sure it's
like, it's very fulfilling. come on.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm curious, like when most of your speeches, are they being done live and then just taped and broadcast? Because there's a virtualness, like even this medium, you know, doing podcasts and Zooms, when it's virtual, you do lose the immediacy of an audience right there. So are your speakers doing their speeches to people live and then they're taped, you know, as done, or are they doing it to camera?
Sadly, until the pandemic hit and hit hard sort of early last year, all of our speeches were really about doing it to a live audience, because I felt that it was, there was something about giving a speech to a live audience that had a magic to it to come back. And therefore, we should encourage that. And actually, people quite enjoyed creating a small event and having speeches and maybe having a social dimension to it afterwards. Mm-hmm. So until now, the focus has been about giving speeches to live audiences. The impact of the pandemic, kind of rolled over World Speech Day, and we've had to adapt like everybody. So this year, we're far more about virtual events and virtual speech making. And we have a global virtual event taking place on the 15th, which will bring together speakers from 100 and so countries. So that's going to be interesting. And it'll be interesting to see the impact that that sort of virtualness has on public speaking. Our theme is humanity at a crossroads. That's our kind of theme for the day. And one can kind of apply that to speeches and speech making, really. Humanity at a crossroads, what does that mean for speeches, for rhetoric, for discourse? You know, how will they be affected? How will they respond? Typically, you know, rhetoric changes in times of disease and plague. So it'll be interesting to see what virtualness does to speech making, and whether there's a kind of new virtual rhetoric that comes out of it, and how.
Oh, people, yeah, for sure. There will be humans. One of the things you got to love about humans is that we adapt to whatever is put in our ecology, and we start to evolve it and get creative with it. And suddenly it becomes this thing that nobody ever predicted. And like Zooms, which are horrible for stand-ups, like trying to capture some of the magic of what it means, because stand-up is a lot of intimacy, you know, with people that are sort of raised up. They're kind of supernatural figures on a stage, and they're kind of celebrities, and it has that aura, you know, and you're intimate with it. So it's in a small room, and it's, you know, it has all that power. Zooms can't capture that, and it's really crushed stand-ups, but you're seeing it's starting to emerge, you know, a new aesthetic with trying to do comedy online, and people will figure it out. And I'm really curious as to what's going to emerge.
Yes. Yes. The big change for us is that we've been about lots of small local events or big regional events taking place all around the world on one day. And that's kind of, if you like, the kind of traditional way that one might approach a world day. You know, be it International Women's Day or Youth Day or whatever, these lots of independent events. With the pandemic, it's forced us to have this global thing. And it really has brought home to me, and I think to others, you know, that's the future. That this notion of all being able to connect so easily and so rapidly, and the notion of world citizenship now, that we're all kind of demigods. We can speak across nations to others in Japan or Sumatra quite easily, and we can converse, and yet we're all the same. What it has shown is that we're no different to people in Nigeria or Vietnam. So this sort of dual notion of global citizenship, I hope will come through this time on World Speech Day, that you know, we have these enormous powers now, so we have greater opportunity to use speeches to change the world, but also we must recognize that we're just the same as everybody else, and have that humility.
Part of my background was in media studies, so I've always sort of taken traditional rhetoric and try to move it over into our evolving, you know, mediums and how it works there. And you see, like with social media and the, you know, cable distribution of content and all these things that have just greatly expanded our ability to access messaging that we would never have accessed before, mm-hmm. you know, at a level and a constancy that people have no idea how to deal with. And you see it in politics, and, you know, I don't follow British politics closely, but I understand, you know, the rise of what I would call unethical, like rhetoric warriors started with the split between ethical rhetoric and unethical rhetoric. Because what I see is with the new distribution system and no gatekeepers, it's just a panacea for unethical persuaders. You know, you can say whatever you want and the production value is incredibly high and it's just a flood of it. Mm-hmm. And people don't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know how to, like over here when Twitter finally shut off Trump, it was like a silence and it went around the whole world.
Yeah.
You know, and that guy, he just monologued in these tiny snippets all the time.
Yeah.
He'd never been assaulted by monologue like that in history, you know, from one person.
No, that was a kind of remarkable set, wasn't it? That he was able to understand better than anybody else how to use Twitter, because he could say what he wanted and in a sense went unchallenged in the monologue that you've just suggested. I guess though, from what I know, and I'm not a classical scholar, but there's always been this distrust about speeches and speech making and making a speech, that it's kind of a double-edged sword. If used to the good, it's a great benefit, but of course, given to the wrong people, it can persuade the people to do all sorts of less than good things. So there has always been that. And, you know, in the early days, of course, they banned speeches and speech writers in particular as being desperately unsavory characters which shouldn't be allowed to sully the minds of young Athenian men.
That's right.
So
you're correct. So
it's a hard one, isn't it? That I wonder whether it's just the new social media that's let this genie out of the box, or whether it's actually kind of all communication is open to both good and abuse.
That is clearly the nature of human communication. And that's why, like I said, I started with the split between ethical and unethical persuasion.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you look at like, and I even saw it on your website, because I want to make sure we focus on your organization here, that you have a few limits on the way you want people, the types of talks you want them to do, like no hate speech, you know, no seditious, you know, type speeches, yes. Which you're making, you know, an ethical choice for people and say, you know, those will cause problems for us. Like, you know, as an organization, if you associate with that, there's a whole, you know, set of warriors, what I would call the rhetoric, you know, the ethical warriors are going to come in and go, don't talk like that.
Yeah. You know?
And it's a very odd space because everybody wants the idea of free speech, but, you know, speech is damaging and it's dangerous and it does need limits like all human activity.
It does. And, you know, one has to be desperately careful where you draw those parameters, don't you? I mean, it's really hard. And one would, of course, just love to be able to say, well, you know, we take all speeches and, you know, that's probably kind of our aim, but we have to have some limitation. And, that's just the way of it, really. I'd rather it was open. I'd rather it was transparent.
Yeah. And transparency is an ethical concept. It's one of the things that keeps people in the ethical camp of persuasion. If you are transparent, you say, here are all the rules, here's what we're doing, then people can judge it. When you close down transparency and you're doing kind of facades
of
persuasion, then that becomes unethical, because then people can't fight through your cover story to get to the reality. And so it's one of those divining rods that you can use when somebody's talking. It's like, well, if we ask them a question, are they transparent about the answer? Do they give all the information and all that kind of stuff? And then, you know, I'm not exactly sure yet what we need to do about the unethical persuaders, other than first, we definitely need to label them.
Yeah.
So that people know, oh, okay, that's what I'm getting.
Yeah. And the more people kind of are aware of speeches and speech making, perhaps the more practiced they are with kind of knowing and being able to tell what's going on and what's happening in a speech. You know, you go back to George Orwell in the 1940s and that wonderful essay, The Politics of the English Language, when he kind of sets out some of the basic rules about how you take apart political discourse and and separate the worthwhile from the humbug, which was rather important in the 1930s and 40s. There were lessons learned. So maybe there is some value in being more aware of speeches and speech making, because we kind of get to learn what's going on in them. We get to learn the unethical traits that are being used, the kind of overlong words, the sophistry that will go with blinding your audience from sort of less than savory facts.
The poor sophists, they have been denigrated down through the ages.
Yeah.
All they were doing was studying technique. Like, hey, here are the techniques.
Yeah.
They can be used for good, they can be used for bad. You know, that's up to you. I can't control you. I can just teach you the techniques.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, morally, I'd be on the side of the kind of intellectual sophists, but they of course started out. I remember going to a conference in London about speeches and speech making a little while ago, and one of the main and very well known judges said that she thought it was really pretty awful that people had speech writers. And that actually you should really just be able to express yourself, and that anything else was really dastardly. And, the first Roman emperor to use a speechwriter was Nero. My case rests, she said.
Untrue. Untruth. She just spoke a public untruth.
And at the time I was sort of slow. I didn't think this through particularly, but most of these techniques were started off in law courts. And one wouldn't really complain about people being represented in a law court by a lawyer or a barrister.
You want somebody
who would give you clever words.
Well, it gives you effective words. Like, here's my split about the sophistication is, are you telling me you want unsophisticated talk that's somehow more moral? Sophisticated talk is more effective. Like, it's not here just to manipulate you. Yes, that's a small subset of rhetoric, but rhetoric is about effective messaging. Don't you want somebody to be taught to be incredibly effective at their communication? You know, it's a silly argument to say people should not have help. They should not become sophisticated in the way they speak, because that's what everybody tries to do in education. They try to increase their vocabulary, increase their skill with communication. And to look over here and say, well, public speaking, you should just get up and just wing it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's silly.
Exactly. Well, as an ex and reformed speechwriter, of course, I couldn't possibly agree with that august lady. And, I think there is a value. And of course, it's ultimately in more effective and more excellent communication. So one would hope that's the way it goes, and more entertaining and more educational and all of those sorts of things that quality ought to be kind of a value that's respected in it.
Well, and that's one of the things I noticed on your website also. Like, you guys do have instruction that a dog or a very aggressive
cat. That's my dog, I'm afraid. Yeah. Can I just stop him whiffing?
Yeah, go ahead. I'll have pause. All right. Simon was attacked by a dog. Saw four dogs flowing into the room, and he dealt with that. So now we're back.
Yeah, I do that as well. Yeah. It's part of my kind of martial arts training in rhetoric. I did hear someone say that's the best kind of analogy for rhetoric is martial arts.
It is. It's very MMA. I have warriors at the center of my brand. I'm like, this is talk war. You know, like when you do rhetoric, you don't do it in a vacuum. When you say things, turns out there are 500 other people that want to respond.
Yeah.
You know, and they want to take your thing apart or, you know, advance it or, you know, detract from it. But there's no such thing as this pristine monologue in the world. But I was saying, like, you're on your website, you know, you guys have instruction on there. You have YouTube videos where you're giving out, you know, some speech instruction for people.
Yeah, we have a range of videos and ebooks and that sort of thing, which are there to help, because Yeah, to come back to, you know, to our mantra of unexpected voices, so many of the people who would come to World Speech Day have maybe never given a speech before. I have absolutely no idea. And in many, many cultures, speech making isn't as kind of prevalent as it is in the US or in Western Europe. So there are many cultures in parts of Asia and Africa where speech making isn't the norm. So people can be introduced to it through World Speech Day and find out a little bit about how they go about making a speech, how they can structure it, how they can, you know, start off by writing out a speech and, you know, getting a sense of the structure, and then moving into some tips on how to perform and to be convincing. And there's no other way very often that they will learn those techniques. They're not taught at school.
Right.
They're not part of society. It's not something their parents can hand down to them, because there isn't a tradition of public speaking. And yet, public speaking has arguably a force for good, in the sense that those things that are spoken publicly, one can be held accountable for. There is an element of truth and record then people can be taken back to. So it has that value. World Speech Day, we like to help where we can.
When people are allowed to speak in public and to monologue in public, it causes the listeners to align somewhere. You know, you can now, like over here with the Black Lives Matter movement, you could easily, once that came into being and became a strong part of our public discourse for a certain amount of time, you know, it comes and goes, but people could align to it. They could either be against it, you know, they could be for it. I have a 21-year-old daughter who's a social justice warrior, like, you know, so many young people are, and she went to some of the protests and she's solidly in line with it.
Yeah.
You know? And it, when you speak in public like that, it gives people the ability to, you know, define themselves in relationship to your issue.
Yeah. So come back to that ethical and unethical bit, though. Something like Black Lives Matter movement has really highlighted that in a very, very interesting way with reference to the no platforming issues, because there is no doubt that the Black Lives Matter movement is thoroughly ethical, thoroughly to be applauded, and thoroughly to be supported. So that's kind of at one level. The problem is when people are no platformed even for talking about it, which it then becomes very difficult. And I did speak to a very delightful and eminent professor in the United States who was being no platformed and cancelled because he had sort of dared to suggest that people ought to be inquisitive about the Black Lives Matter movement, to question it, to probe, such that we have a more intelligent response. And I sense that even just, you know, talking about it makes, you know, opens one up to criticism. But I think it is back to that ethical and unethical thing. You've got to tread carefully to know what is right, but also to have the opportunity to discuss openly the issues that are raised without feeling that they are no-go areas.
Well, there again, you know, when we're talking about the value of sophisticated communication, if you want to understand the necessity and value of having really good training, talk about a difficult issue like this in public.
Yes.
Because if you are not sophisticated about it, then you will step onto landmines that you may not intend in any way, and it will be a real problem for you. And I see this a lot with, you know, the Me Too movement that happened over here with so many males all at one time. Like, it hit with like all these sort of rolling exposés that happened all at one time with Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein over here. And there was a comedian, Louis C.K., who got, you know, pulled up into that same, you know, group of villains.
Yes.
If you get pulled over into a villain space, by anyone, and anybody can do it to you.
Yeah.
That's the other thing about rhetoric. You can accuse anybody of anything. And at that point, you suddenly go, you know what? Here's what your thought should be. I need a rhetorician to help me with this.
Yeah.
Because this is a very sophisticated and nuanced situation, and they never get that help. So they end up, you know, not coming out of it. Like, there's a 2,500 year history of apologia in rhetoric, like how to effectively apologize. And they clearly don't know it, you know, because they do a horrible job of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, it's very interesting how both of those particular subjects have gone through the media, and how little service social media has done for either of them in a way, because it has polarized without any greater, more nuanced discussion, which I guess the rhetorician
nuance very well. That's not its nature.
The
media is fireworks. You know,
it's shock and awe. Yes.
I worked in Hollywood for 10 years, and it's just, how do we keep as many fireworks in the air as possible?
Yes.
And that's just the nature of that business. That's, you know, the way it's run. But like, I think it's interesting you hearkening back so much to the history of speech making, because speech making is different than that. Speech making is slow. It's deliberate. Mm-hmm. It's a single person having a single extended turn to make sometimes a very extended, complicated argument.
Yeah.
That's just an unusual, like, you will never see a full speech broadcast on TV. Like, anymore, unless they're a major politician.
Well, see, that's crazy, isn't it? I mean, I'm one of the few people in the world who listen to a full speech, and enjoy it. I read speeches. I don't just get the soundbite. And that's very, very important, to read the whole thing or to listen to the whole thing, because the soundbite is there to mislead you, basically.
It's the juiciest thing they can find. And sometimes it is like, it's clipped out by your opposition, you know, by your competition.
Yeah.
And that's their job, is to make you look bad. They don't want to make you look good.
Yeah.
But
absolutely. I used to listen to speeches by President Ahmadinejad from Iran. And, he occasionally addressed the UN, and the media would have a field day with tearing his speeches apart and putting them into little sound bites that made him look even more villainous characters than ever. And he may not have been that wonderful a person to his pets, but he was a very interesting speaker. And his speeches were very, very good to the United Nations and well worth reading, because what you understood then was that there were enormous cultural differences in speech making in different nations, and that came across in somebody like his speeches, because the West was interpreting a speech made in the Arab world as something very different than it was,
right.
And something that's evolved in World Speech Day has been this greater notion of the difference, the different cultural differences in speeches and speech making and how they're delivered, and you know, that's all very interesting, and how, what a minefield it is if you're a non-native English speaker to give a speech in English, how easy it is to offend, and vice versa, you know, how easy it is for an English speaking audience to misinterpret speeches made in other contexts.
Yeah. And I mean, I know cross-cultural monologue, cross-cultural talk from a lot of different perspectives, like the humor doesn't transfer across cultures very well. You know, Netflix likes to pull on international stand-ups quite a bit. It's probably because they get them cheap. You know, they buy their specials and they
surely not
pay them almost nothing for it. But I try to watch it. Like, there's a guy, Gad something from France, and apparently did very well in France. Like, it was one of their leading stand-ups, and I watched it and I just couldn't access the comedy.
Yeah.
It's just so different, you know, and so much.
It's probably because he was French.
Well, you know, French have an intellectual tradition. I like intellectual comedy. I'm like, that's what I'm going to get, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I got kind of mugging and clownery, and I'm like, it doesn't do it for me, you know, as an American. And so, you know, when you go across cultures, and that's one of the things I'm interested in looking at, you know, some of your people from the World Speech Day, like when they come from a highly verbal, like Western cultures, like European cultures, sort of, you know, Britain and America, it's controlled talk. Like our speeches are highly formalized and controlled, and even the emotional modulation, you know, is only within a certain range. When you go to like a fully oral tradition culture, like you saw it some in our inauguration when they brought in the young Black poet who came from a, you know, sort of spoken word tradition.
Yes.
She sounded so different than everybody else who talked that day. Yes. And it's because she had that, you know, sort of spoken word rhythm and emotionality and emotional tone changes. And it just was starkly, it's just starkly different because it was such a cultural, you know, different form of speaking. So I'm curious as to how much of that you get, like if you watch these across the different cultures, it must be shockingly different in the way that they do their...
They're very different, but I watched a speech by a speaker in Indonesia. He was addressing a local, what looked like a local village group. And my Indonesian is a little rusty, so I wasn't kind of fully up to speed on what he was saying, but... It was fascinating. It was wonderful to feel the response from the crowd, the oohs and ahs and that they'd have. So I got a real fun out of just listening to the speech because of the sense of what was going on. And that's something that's unique to speech making, I think. That, well, perhaps not if you look at comedy or whatever, but you know, there's this thing of being live in front of people. The whole gives you the sense of what's going on, not just the speaker.
Well, and the power of, you know, a group of human beings, like when they tape sitcoms, they have live audiences because it's such a death to comedy, no matter what. Even if you're filming it and if you're trying to add in laugh tracks later on, it's not the same. Just the energy of, you know, communicating with a massive group of people. And I've always loved it. Like I loved it when I was a professor, the bigger the class, the better. As a stand-up, the bigger the audience, the better. It morphs when you would talk to bad audiences, like audiences that want to compete with you, that becomes a different issue. But when you get an audience that wants to listen, you know, and is open to you being the speaker and taking their role, which is to receive and to communicate, you know, their response, it's amazing.
Yes.
I would think like, cross-culturally, it'd be super fun to watch, you know, the different ways that audiences and speakers interact across cultures.
It is, yes. It's very interesting, sometimes very moving. You can have a room of 250 young Nigerian female students gathered together in a hall and a speaker, and that experience will be, you know, I defy you not to sort of feel that as quite an amazing experience, both as a listener and as a participant. So, you know, there are lots of very interesting dimensions to watching speech making in different cultures, both what they inform you of your own efforts and also what they tell you about those cultures, and dare one say what we have to learn from them.
I'm curious, like, what your challenges have been on marketing this, because again, you're sort of rescuing what, it's not a lost art form, but it's certainly not a primary art form in America here. And, you know, in most of the modern world, speech making is still alive. It's still around, but it can't compete with, you know, televised sitcoms and movies and even social media and YouTube and people just sort of accessing their messaging that way. This is it's a really old art form, and it is infused with a lot of morality and power, but it's also kind of stained with a lot of, you know, immorality. Like when Hitler came up and, you know, has all his, you know, all the footage of him giving speeches at massive rallies, you know, that's when people started to get really scared of mass public persuasion. You know, they labeled it propaganda and they're like, here are all the techniques. And we started to have a fear of it.
Yes.
You know, and you're going back beyond, behind that and sort of pulling up more of the Greek, you know, Roman tradition of, you know, good people speaking well in public. And what have been your challenges to get, like, what's been the reaction to people when you bring this concept up to them?
Well, I think the reaction, first of all, was why, as with all these things. But secondly, there is, I think, a general perception that, you know, speeches are still the best way of spreading ideas. So that really, you know, works for people.
And TED Talks are speeches, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was going to come back to, you know, TED Talks are speeches, and they have 40 million hits a day. As it
people
were.
Like
so,
it.
So the art of speech making is not dead. We've just got to find new ways to do it and new ways to get it appreciated and new ways. I think it'd be really fascinating if there was a space in every large village or town for public discourse. What would that do if people were allowed and encouraged to make a speech to their local communities on a regular basis about the things that they felt mattered? Would that community feel more together? Would it feel more involved? Would it feel better informed as a result of speeches? I'd be fascinated if that was, you know, would somebody took that up and really gave it a social effort, because I think it could make a big difference. I think you would find that parts of the community which didn't trust one another, that didn't know one another, might come together more easily because they could see one another speaking and sharing ideas. And there's always the notion that, you know, cabbages would be thrown and violence would ensue if you speak your mind in public. And there is always, you know, some degree of, you know, the loony who talks on the wrong subjects. But nevertheless, I think if you gave people the trust and the opportunity to speak in public about the things that mattered to them, that would bring people together. And World Speech Day is just a tiny little effort to do that. And maybe it will catch on and people will have more regular events around the world more frequently than just one day. And, you know, speeches and speech making will become more of our way of life, not less. There's no reason why that shouldn't be. We've got all the techniques, all the technology. It's just somebody needs to start experimenting.
Have you gotten media coverage for World Speech Day? Like, what's your...
I don't think we're a media darling.
How do they spin it?
How do they spin it? Originally, the big media companies thought it was entirely irrelevant, that it was a nice, charming little exercise, but it was... The sense was that this is people who really don't matter giving speeches, if I'm honest. You know, that clever, important people don't do this sort of thing. They wait for the media to listen to them and then they give a speech on television to a very small audience. I mean, British prime ministers now, outside of the parliament, seem to speak to about 15 people in a factory. But because the television cameras are there, we're made to think that there's a vast audience and they're, you know, being grilled on every word. So initially the media just dismissed it. I'm hoping that as we build year after year, things improve. And we certainly get far better coverage in Sumatra or Asia or Mongolia or Hong Kong or in Pakistan than we do in the West. So there's a lesson that where speeches are newer, there's greater appetite to discover and to gain news about them. And we're perhaps rather too jaundiced now about speeches and speech making, and that's a shame.
Well, it's so my double background of rhetoric and Hollywood, you know, Hollywood production techniques and understanding what Hollywood and the media need for stories to work, you know, and the forces that come to bear on whatever messaging you do, if it's pulled over into Hollywood or the media, they have to apply their forces to it, right?
Yes.
So celebrity, like I think of Malala, is that her name, Malala?
Yes.
how she emerged, you know, out of a horrible
one event. one speech.
Yeah. And
in the United Nations
became, but she had already worked her way to that. Like there was, she had worked her way through a fame ladder, you know, of people knowing who she was, knowing her story,
yep.
You know, and there's some kind of production structure behind her. I promise. There's a PR yep. structure, not in a bad way at all. Again, I like it when good people have really good resources to get their message out into the world. They should yeah. have all the production help. They should have all the PR help. They should have
like Greta, exactly the same. Greta Thunberg is exactly the same. Yeah.
You know, and, but by the time she got there and she was ready for that moment and she had some celebrity and some care, the right character and the right story and did a great job on the speech, you saw the power of that, you know, yeah. to raise everything up. And if you had your Malala, I guess, you know, they would raise up your organization in the same swale of, you know.
Yes. I remember a journalist from the Times, London Times, asking me, what's the angle? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the kind of, you know, really the nub of it. What is the angle that they can write about? And, you know, is that different, a different story? And with something like World Speech Day, I'm probably, you know, it probably doesn't have that kind of angle. It might do if a celebrity, and this year on the global virtual event, we're looking at involving some sort of iconic speakers into the mix so that we kind of build in a bit more, you know, media friendliness, just to raise our profile. You know, it's this simple kind of law. We would probably benefit from that, and we have to balance that with our overall aim of giving people unexpected voices the opportunity to speak. It's a balancing act, and you know, it's great fun to come and, you know, chat on these sorts of shows and things, because it gives me an opportunity to make more people aware
right.
of World Speech Day, and that's fun, and I'm very grateful.
Well, and I think your line, your sort of promotional line there of unexpected voices is strong. I think that's a really nice offer. People would, I guess, immediately jump to, well, give me examples of the most, you know, unexpected voices. Like the media has to have people. They have to have
yeah.
a character, and it has to play out in an easily absorbable story, usually with good and evil. You know, and good winning out. It has to
yeah,
have these
yeah,
touch points,
yeah.
you know, these narrative touch points, because people process it so fast. They've got to be able to look at it, know what it is, get hooked, and, you know, be willing to watch the story play out. And so, like, even
yes,
you, like, I saw you, you know, on LinkedIn, and I saw the World Speech Day, and I'm hooked by that, because, you know, I like rhetoric. And I'm like, well, that's an interesting idea. And I started going in and to your materials and pulling out, well, what is the story here? You know, and you're part
yeah.
of the story. You know, I think getting to know you now and sort of why you're in the middle of this and how you got involved, I think is a really nice story. You know?
Yeah.
Are there people that have done the speeches in the past that you would be able to highlight, that you would point to, like, oh, this was just an amazing, unexpected voice?
Yeah. I mean, every year, tens of hundreds, in the sense that, you know, I'm constantly amazed by the ability of a young speaker in South America, in Buenos Aires, you know, fantastic tradition of rhetoric in South America, great, they're always sort of naturally great speakers, but they also understand speeches and speech making. But I'm constantly amazed by the skills of, you know, natural skills of people. But then equally, I'm also so very often touched by the human stories that come into speech making. I think of a guy who spoke at last year's event in Houston, who had been diagnosed as sort of, you know, terminal, but a few months before had pulled through his diagnosis. And the thing that kept him going was being able to make a speech on World Speech Day. Because it really mattered him to get up and do that. A lady in Hong Kong talking, sorry, a lady in Singapore talking about the impact of a stroke on her life and how that had changed her as a person, and very simply as her ability to make a speech. She was a Toastmaster, loved public speaking, and the impact of a speech. And of course, the impact of the stroke on her ability to make a speech, far from diminishing it, made her one of the most compelling speakers I've ever come across, because there in every word was her story.
Yeah.
So no, it's great. All the time. It's all the time. But those are individual examples. And, you know, I sit at the center of it and I enjoy it. And I've somehow got to find a way to bring that to life. Maybe a virtual event will do that in the sense of people will be able to experience the variety of someone from Malta talking about artificial intelligence, and the next minute someone from Norway talking about the prison rehabilitation system there and how many lessons there are to be learned, because they're sort of world leaders. All of these things are about humanity at a crossroads in terms of how we learn from one another to get better so that we go forward. And so that's the other great thing about World Speech Day. We have a kaleidoscope of ideas. You know, there's the notion that if you just go to a conference about technology, all you're going to learn about is technology. But if you go to something where you cross fertilize disciplines, those ideas mix and merge, and you learn far more as a process. So in World Speech Day, there is that variety, that kaleidoscopic effect, which I hope is worthwhile.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is my Hollywood producer / rhetoric brain looking at your stuff, and because I love promoting things like this, and as I figure out how to promote something like rhetoric training to make us much safer as a democracy, which is the idea behind what I do. I match it up with humor sometimes, because humor is a nice, magic carpet to get behind people's defenses. And with yours, I think of like just a Hollywood producer thing, like they would maybe turn you into all the world speeches, and that's great, but like a competition, like the top 10 speeches every year. And then, people could watch this and vote, just like, American Idol with speeches.
Yeah.
And that would be an interesting pitch. Like if you pitched that to a production company, say, we're getting all these great things in. Let's take the top 10 every year. And then for the next 4 weeks or whatever, do a produced show where people get to hear, the progressive speeches that these guys do and vote on it. And it's all around the world. Might be an interesting way of pitching something like that into a bigger, into that medium, which needs things like conflict and drama and, story and characters. But I would love to see, people know more about this. So,
yeah. Well, of course, debating is high drama, isn't it? And that's the meat and drink of rhetoric. So that's, that could be something that does lend itself to sort of mass communication. And, in the UK, we have all sorts of TV programs about choirs competing, or chefs competing, or all sorts of people competing. Why not speakers or debaters or whatever? Because we'd probably quite enjoy.
Well, and I think yours, the purity of monologue, debate bothers me, because debate, it's too much. It's too much dialogue, and it's too much artifice, and it's warring, like I don't enjoy watching logic slam into logic, but a speech has all the emotion, has all the story, has all the character, that it has a richness, especially if they're very well developed. People across, that big a community of speakers is going to well up very talented and very, story rich people. And I think you get a lot of interest in that once it's cooked like that. Again, this is just me sort of,
Sure. Well, we're 6 years into it. We think it's the beginning of a very long journey to bring speeches out, to celebrate speeches, to make people kind of analyze what's going on, think about it. And to bring out this kind of notion that speeches can be something of benefit to society in a very kind of small b way, if you know what I mean. Not something to be grandiose about, but to see what, you know, I mean, the Greeks built their entire civilization around, first of all, clearing a little space, and then making that into an agora, and then saying, who wants to speak? And that was the beginning of a Western civilization, who wants to speak? So that might be quite a useful guide to how we can take things on.
Yeah, that's great. Well, this has been super fun. I really appreciate you jumping on and doing a podcast. Like I said, when I find people interested in the same things that I'm interested in, it's just kind of like, I want to talk to that person. So
lovely. Well, it's been great fun, and it's lovely to sort of share banter with someone who inhabits the same slightly rarefied world of rhetoric and speeches. And that's always a great pleasure. And this has been lots of fun. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Yeah. I'll circle back around and stay in contact, and appreciate it very much. Everybody, this is Simon Gibson. Go to worldspeechday.com. Is that right?
Correct.
And check it out, because it's more than just a worthy thing. It's a very interesting thing, and I'm really curious as to see where it's going to go. And again, thanks for listening to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Head over to rhetoricwarriors.com. Take a persuasion course. It turns out great persuasion changes everything. So we'll see you next time.